We are in Brussels, in one of the buildings of the European Parliament. The other is in Strasbourg, France. I come from Portugal, from Lisbon. I am an historian and a writer, and I have been elected an independent MEP member of the European Parliament. I'm in the Green Group now.
You were the rapporteur on the issues surrounding Hungary and civil rights and the changes to the constitution. First of all, just explain to me what article within the treaty you feel that they have really challenged, that they are signatories to. So explain about Article 2 in the treaty.
Okay, so, well, for Australian listeners, maybe it's people are used to the European Union as being the former European Economic Community. So it was an industrial and economic joint venture from post-war, but of course always carrying the values of surpassing the European rivalries that had caused two wars in the last century. Recently, the European Union acquired an article, Article 2, that you mentioned, where the values, the foundations of the Union actually are mentioned. And these foundations are, six, to put it succinctly. Respect for human dignity, democracy, rule of law, liberty, equality, and respect for human rights, including the rights of persons coming from minorities. So these are the six pillars, so to say, of the European Union in terms of democratic values, rule of law, and fundamental rights. And they have been chosen, this article has been drafted by the member states themselves. For instance, the part that I just told you about, the rights of persons coming from minorities, was a suggestion of the Hungarian government of the time. Because, of course, there are many Hungarian minorities outside Hungary proper, and they were rightly worried about the linguistic rights, the rights of association and movement, and political rights of their minorities in Romania, Slovakia, or other EU countries. So the point is that this Article 2 is not one of those bureaucratic inventions from Brussels that, you know, sometimes get talked about in the press. It's not like the size of cucumbers or, you know, the curvature of bananas or whatever. Article 2 is about the foundations of the Union that should underpin all our democratic systems in this continent and in this Union. And it was drafted by the member states themselves. They chose these values. So the question for us is, do we take these values seriously or not? Do we act on them or not? And do we uphold these values or not?
So with the changes that have been made by the government of Viktor Orbán since 2010, how do you see that they challenge or test the boundaries of that treaty?
Well, I think that what has happened in Hungary in the last years is a lesson in what can happen to a democracy anywhere in the world. First, you had a collapse of trust in the government before Viktor Orbán's government, pursuant to several declarations of the prime minister and a real or perceived mistrust between the electorate and that prime minister. Hungary went to the polls, and Mr. Orbán's party had a 50% share of the vote. But with the electoral system that Hungary had in place, that awarded him 2/3 of the members of parliament. With 2/3 of the members of parliament, this majority could change the constitution any time, which they did. They changed 12 times the old constitution. Then they drafted a new one completely, apparently per the description of a colleague of mine in the European Parliament, Mr. Josef Sayer. A big chunk of this new constitution was written on his iPad. So it was a creation of the ruling party itself, which is called the Fidesz party.
And this was unfettered power to change the constitution. They didn't have to go to the parliament to get permission because of that majority.
Well, they had the majority in parliament. So the constitution formally was changed in parliament. We informally and by the press and even statements of the Fidesz leaders themselves, we know that it was mostly written by the party itself. There was a kind of a social consultation in order to do the constitution. The questions were very vague, and this didn't seem to amount to anything. So the constitution was approved in parliament with the two-thirds of a fixed majority that the ruling party has. The opposition did not participate in the drafting of the new constitution, and after this constitution came into force, which was January of 2012, the constitution has already been changed 5 times. So even the new constitution that was completely the work of the party in power had to be changed already 5 times. Partly it's because they have been so detailed in the constitution. They wanted to constitutionalize most of what was their own political platform. And then if this political platform encounters problems, either, problems in reality or blocks that they hadn't think about before, then the constitution has to be changed again.
So these are changes along ideological lines?
Yes, very clearly ideological lines. As I said, the opposition almost didn't participate in this procedure, as it has not been participating in the lawmaking procedure at large, because not only the constitution has been changed, but hundreds of new laws have been approved and implemented already. A new parliamentary procedure allows for laws presented by an individual member of parliament to be passed through in an expedite manner. So this means that sometimes we have had laws on data protection, for instance, that were suggested by individual members of the ruling party in a Sunday, discussed in a Monday, and approved Tuesday. And then, of course, they have to be promulgated by the president of the republic that has also been appointed by the same majority. Also, other than the constitution and the legal framework, also there were many appointments of key people in the administration, including, for instance, the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's name has been changed, which formally makes it into a new constitution, which has allowed the majority to curtail the mandate of the previous president of the Supreme Court. They implemented a new provision on the experience that the head of the Supreme Court should have, and because this man called Boca had come from the European Court of Human Rights, he was not eligible for the new Supreme Court, renamed Curia, and now there is a new Supreme Court with a new president. The same has happened with the media authority. That was a new media authority that has extensive powers over the media, with the Ombudsman, with the data protection authority, for instance, that has also, they have created a new data protection authority, and up to a point there were two data protection authorities, but one was defunded and de-staffed, and the new one, of course, had the funds and the staff. And all these appointments are for 9 years. And if in the end of the 9 years there is not a two-thirds majority to appoint a new person, the person that was appointed now stays, which means that theoretically some of these people can stay for up to 18 years or even more. Also, an important point that I think in a sense is the keystone of all this edifice is the new national security law, whereby a top civil servant, meaning someone that works in the ministry, the diplomatic service, agencies of the state, can be wiretapped for 2 periods of up to a month. And those are not continuous, so it's 2 months in the year that can be February and September, for instance. But, of course, you will never know. It's the Secret Service can access content of private communication, not only the metadata, but what's written inside emails, what's said during telephone calls, and this extends also to family members. If a national security issue is encountered, then this person can be fired, and of course the proceeding goes through a different path that the one that would be through normal courts. You can challenge the fact that you've been fired, but this goes through the executive. So the minister of the sector where you work will pronounce if the firing was correct or not, if your acquittal was correct or not, and then it can go all the way to the prime minister. And because it is a national security issue, it will be very difficult to know exactly what was the issue that was encountered during these wiretaps. So
very no redress.
There is not a normal course for redress, and this is for the people. So people say, is this to wiretap the opposition or anything? No, it seems that it is mostly directed at the appointees that the government has appointed itself, because these people have been given very long mandates, of course, and also possibility of renewing their mandates. So in a sense, it can be directed at these appointees. And I think that it, in a sense, it is a keystone of the whole edifice of what's happening in Hungary. And of course, being national security is something that is outside of the realm of European Union jurisdiction.
So you mentioned one thing there that is also alarming is controls and changes to media law. Mm. And also the other thing has have been a real reduction in the protections against minorities, protections for minorities. So those two things have been also especially alarming much further abroad. So first of all, just explain what has set off the alarm bells within the media, changes to media law, because I believe licensing issues have become much more difficult. There was a radio station club, student radio station that was denied a license because it was a dissenting voice.
Okay, so first of all, the media, because regarding minorities, the landscape, I would say it's more complex than seems at first. So media, that was really the first thing that concerned us here in the European Parliament, because this new media law allowed for a new media authority that had been where all members are appointed by a two-thirds majority, but they were all appointed by the same two-thirds majority, again with no participation of the opposition. Many of these people were well-known supporters of the party in power. Then you seldom find but it's very difficult to find one of these appointments from the last 2 years, this even admitted by people from the Fidesz, at least informally in personal communication. You seldom find someone from the other side that is appointed, someone independent that is appointed. It's mostly people that are very close to power. So the media authority has a board of people that have been appointed by this majority. They can wage fines, I believe this is the way they say, or raise fines on media titles, newspapers, radios, televisions, that go all the way up to 800,000 euros. For most newspapers and radios, this puts you out of business. Even a cable TV, it's very hard to pay this fine. We have tried to ask the Hungarian authorities to at least suspend the fines while the process is still pending in court, but we haven't been successful. They have kept the fines in the beginning of the process, so you have to pay first, then you can go to court. And in case you won, you know, a couple of years down the road, then you get your money back. But most, newspapers or radios won't be able to sustain that kind of, pay the fine and then have pay the legal fees and survive in the end of this process.
And what are these fines for? Are they trivial?
Well, lack of objectivity, for instance, lack of neutrality and these kind of things. But the problem is that the interpretation of what this means, and also importantly for the minority question, offenses to the dignity of minorities or offenses to the dignity of the Hungarian nation. And this we'll discuss, I hope, in a different point. The problem is that the interpretation of this lack of objectivity, this lack of impartiality, this lack of neutrality on the part of the media is decided by the board of the media authority, and that many people have trouble seeing as an impartial arbiter itself. And then you have other, other laws and other aspects of the media action of the government that are of concern. For instance, the fact that public TVs and radios can only use one news agency. So the news that they get are only from a news agency. I myself have had the experience of hearing the debates in the European Parliament, see that the message has been scrambled because they only can use one source, and that source is the public news agency. Then there's a new thing, a new law that I haven't had the time to assess, so I will only give you the gist of this. After an electoral scandal in a town called Baia, where both the Socialists and the Fidesz party accused themselves of, trying to perform vote fraud. There was a video. This video was proved to be a fake, and now there's one of these individual MPs' bills in the Hungarian parliament that proposes jail terms for people who produce fake videos. And then if they show them, it's an even harsher penalty, and if they show them to a wide audience, even harsher. So, we'll still need to see if this goes to the Constitutional Court or not, what happens. Sometimes the Constitutional Court has acted as a counterweight. Maybe minorities? Minorities, the Hungarian government has been active in legislation concerning and even protecting minorities. So it is not, I would say, one of these sections of their activity, such as, separation of powers or independence of the judiciary or even the media, where the case is clear-cut. In minorities, there are now provisions against hate crime and against hate speech. My problem is that I don't see them uniformly applied. There is a great deal of police passivity that NGOs refer to in their reports when there are attacks on Roma people, for instance. There seems to be a very asymmetrical application of the law regarding people who are found to be, offending the dignity of the Hungarian nation. And this can be something as the case of a writer called Ákos Kertész, that has had to apply for asylum in Canada, and asylum was granted to him because he had written that Hungarians were genetically subservient, which, of course, it's something that can be seen as offensive and that we can deplore being written, but it's, I would say, in a different plane than what a gentleman called Zsolt Bayer, who's a founding member of the Fidesz, has written about Roma people, saying that they are animals, that they utter with their mouths whatever noise, comes out of their head, and that they are a problem and a nuisance that must be, resolved in any way possible, which, if you know European history, hearing this statement, makes your blood chill. And nothing was done in this case. So, hate speech and laws are always delicate matters. It's always a question of balance. You don't want hate speech laws to go too far. Then there is a tendency now to have them and to we want them to be reasonable, of course. So the Hungarian government tries to find a balance as everybody tries to find a balance. But in the implementation side of it, we see huge asymmetries. And then, of course, the Constitution forbids speech or introduces limitations to the freedom of speech in cases of offenses to the dignity of the Hungarian nation or of other ethnic communities. The European Court of Human Rights has already had problems with similar laws coming from Turkey, for instance, where insults to Turkishness were, prosecuted and punished. So we have doubts as to the extent of this limitation of freedom of speech regarding offenses to the dignity of the Hungarian nation and other ethnic communities, because it seems too vague. And the problems with any limitation of freedom of speech that are too vague is that then that can be applied in an arbitrary manner.
So sitting here in Brussels, mm-hmm. to what extent is this perhaps all about domestic politics, and how much of it is actually a challenge to the authority of Brussels, mm-hmm. of the European Union? Because it feels like this is genuinely trying to call the bluff of Brussels, trying to sort of test how strong Brussels really, moral and legal authority really is?
Well, we've had cooperation from the Hungarian government. We have political dialogue with them. I wouldn't be able to answer as to their intentions. I don't know. I cannot say if it's calling the bluff or if it's they would probably answer that the EU is going too far. I think that what's fair to say is that in these kind of issues of democratic values, rule of law, and fundamental rights, there is not, and I think there has not been for a long time in Europe, over a century, a case that you can say it's clearly a national case and not an European case. We went to war 100 years ago, and Australians actually came from the other side of the world to die in an European war because we weren't able to solve the issue of shared prosperity, democracy for all, and the same fundamental rights applying to minorities and ethnic minorities and majorities across the European continent. This was the original problem before World War I, and this was what caused several generations of tragedies in Europe. The Hungarians themselves know about this, because in 1956, when they revolted against Soviet power, they said, and this is recorded in documents of the Council of Europe, we are dying for freedom and Europe in Hungary. So they know that there is no domestic and European side to this. It's both the same thing. If we abandon a country of the European Union to a backslide in democracy and rule of law, then it's worse for all of us. So I see this as about Hungary, but much more than about Hungary. We have problems in Greece, where there is a Nazi party in parliament. We have problems in Romania, where the constitution was being discussed behind closed doors. Every problem is different. For it's like in Tolstoy, every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. But then you have Bulgaria, where a media tycoon has been appointed the chief of the secret service. Then this appointment had to be taken back. In Portugal, you have a huge pressure on journalistic work because, of course, the country has no money. The people who are buying newspapers and televisions nowadays in Portugal are Angolan generals who have money from diamond and oil. Journalists in my country, they tend to self-censor when they speak about Angola. And this, the Portuguese community in Australia knows very well. Many of them came precisely from Portuguese-speaking Africa. You had problems during the Berlusconi era, Italy, and it's still not solved. Then you have problems in also the UK, other countries. So either Europe, faces this test with utmost seriousness and once and for all develops mechanisms for the rule of law where we can say we have huge diversity in this continent. We have monarchies and republics, and we have bicameral parliaments and unicameral parliaments, and we have countries with constitutional courts and without them, written constitutions and unwritten constitutions. But all of them have to be compatible with these six values of democracy, rule of law, liberty, equality, respect for human dignity, human rights, and minorities. It's not a huge thing to ask. If we were to be even more ambitious, then we will talk about the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the EU that gives you many more interesting rights, right to data protection, many rights of personality, rights of access to information, etc. But that at this moment, this Charter of Fundamental Rights is only limited to, what here nobody calls, but is almost in fact a federal level. So it only applies if your rights are violated by the European Commission. And it does not apply in the internal order of the member states. This would be an ambitious goal, and I support it. But this is a goal that is still not in the books in the European Union. Inasmuch as Article 2, with these six values, were values that any democracy has to respect and has to share, is in the Lisbon Treaty from December 2009. It's something that we have to take with, in a very serious manner.
So what is the solution for European Union? Is it possible with Europe the way it is, or does it require Union to become a federation? What needs to change to allow Europe the sort of control over these sorts of things and the effective dialogue that it needs to have with a country like Hungary or Romania?
Well, one can be an European federalist or not, but I think that we can work this out without being a federation. So if you make this dependent on Europe first being a federation and solving these issues, it's a no-go. I think that we need to realize that all the things that all the competences that the European Union has and all the facets of its personality, such as the single market, such as Erasmus, which is this program where students go from country to country to do a part of their courses or a part of their degrees. Schengen, which means that we can cross borders. Now we don't have borders as we had before, at least in a big part of Europe. All of this depends on mutual trust. Depends on, for instance, the simple fact that a Portuguese judge is also a European judge and applies Portuguese and European law. If in one link of the European chain we identify a problem, for instance, of interference in the work of the judges, such as the one that we identified in Hungary, and the Hungarian government, to its credit, has had to change it, which was the fact that it could, via a political appointee, stop a court case on its tracks in a given court and send it to another court in the middle of the judicial process. For instance, if you identify this kind of problems, it means that the judicial in a member state is not trustable enough. So it means that, for instance, a Czech company having business in Hungary will not be sure if they will have a fair trial or not, and it could be the other way around. If we start to unravel this question of mutual trust, of, for instance, just to give you the example of courts, this means that you cannot work because everybody will be then introducing protections on their own to protect their companies or their citizens.
And it's a loss of harmony in terms of rules.
It is a loss of harmony. So what you have to do is put the ball in the camp of the governments of the member state and say, we have identified rule of law issues in your country. Of course, this identification must follow a procedure, and this procedure has to be also fair and apply across the board, big and small countries, founding members and recent accessions. But once these problems have been identified, then you have to tell to the government of the member state that we will sit at the table and discuss Article 2 issues, meaning rule of law and fundamental rights and democratic values issues. And while we do not finish, while we don't settle the Article 2 issues, the rule of law issues that we have identified, the rest must, in a way, wait. You know, it takes second role. If the problem is serious enough, it should be suspended. So that the government feels also the need or feels the encouragement to get done with solving the problems in the rule of law and democratic values that were identified. The same goes for institutions, because, of course, also the European Commission, the European Parliament, all sorts of agencies that the European Union has also have to respect the same values, and also even pan-European parties that we now have, like the European Green Party or whatever. They must respect these values. Otherwise, you know, how can they, you know, get funding from the European taxpayer? We are not telling them to respect specific doctrines or ideologies or whatever. I think that we have to have a very open field, but everybody has to respect human dignity and everybody has to respect democracy and the rule of law and fundamental rights. So I think that you can achieve all this with the setup that you already have. Maybe I will just add one institution, which will be a kind of a, we call it the Copenhagen Commission, because Copenhagen is the name that we give to the criteria that you have to accept when you are a candidate to the European Union. So now, for instance, Serbia is a candidate, or any other country, or Iceland was a candidate until recently, and now they have suspended their negotiations. In order to be, for a country to be a candidate and then to accede to the European Union, this country has to have high standards in, you know, democratic practices, rule of law, etc. What makes no sense is for us to be so demanding for an applicant country, and then after the country accedes, say, okay, you're now a member of the club, you know, you can do whatever you want. the fact that we did not create mechanisms to focus on this kind of problem is because we were, as was everybody, I think, in the 90s mostly, we were very naive about progress towards democracy. Everybody thought at the time that this was a one-way road, that you would progress towards democracy, and that, you know, our view of the world back then was very binary. You had either dictatorships or democracies. And when you, you know, went from one pole to the other, then you were a democracy and you stayed a democracy. Now in the new century, we know that you have many things in between. What sometimes we call majoritarian regimes, such as Putin's Russia and others. The closest example in the EU would be Mr. Orban's Hungary. And these majoritarian regimes are, you know, partly democratic or formally democratic, partly, you know, more authoritarian. They are not dictatorships as the ones that we knew from Indonesia, Suharto or whatever. But they also do not give enough room for the opposition, civil society. You know, they are not up to the standards that we wished.
And they can legislate to make sure that it stays that way.
Yes, and you know, backsliding has occurred. In the case of Hungary, we have identified it. So this naive view that, you know, you would, it was, you know, this glorious climb to democracy for everybody, sometimes you slide down. And this has happened in the new millennium, in the new century, by the effect of the economic crisis, populist leaders, etc. Everywhere we have been seeing that, you know, it's not that you're going back to dictatorship, but democracy is receding in many places, inside the EU and outside the EU.
Are you worried?
Well, it worries me a lot, because if this has happened, and if you have gone behind in just a matter of 5 to 10 years, in the case of the, you know, Eurozone crisis, it's 5 years, then imagine how it can be in 5 years from now if the trend is still the same. It worries me a lot. It worries me a lot when you know, I see the developments in Greece. I come from a country that was a dictatorship until 1974. I was still born in the dictatorship, although 2 years before the revolution. And the point of joining the EU was to not, you know, not be abandoned anymore in the dictatorship while the rest of you know, Western Europe at the time was enjoying democratic freedoms. But if it goes on this way, you just have to kind of, you know, follow the trend with your mind, and then you start to worry with what can be, you know, down the road in 5 years or even 10 years from now. And of course, you know, saying that these things don't happen in Europe, which is sometimes the reaction from Europeans, that these things do not happen. We are not, you know, Latin America or Southeast Asia or whatever. It is just fooling yourself, because Europe is actually where these things happen. They haven't been happening in a while, but they have happened in the past. Then those people from 100 years ago, they were not, you know, more stupid than we are. They were all, at the time, they were the best politicians, the best diplomats, the best, you know, military, the best academics that they had. And yet they descended into this inhuman, uncivilized, you know, state for that then lasted for generations, actually. Those were very cultured, very bright Europeans in 1913, 1914. So there is nothing except us taking very seriously what is happening. But other than that, there is nothing stopping it from happening again.
Thank you very much, Ruud Tavares. Thank you for joining me on Law Report.
Okay, well, thank you very much for inviting me.